What's your name?
It's hard to say in English.
Well, just say in your language.
All right. My name is...
Well, my name is Carrie Thompson, and I don't speak mermaid like Daryl Hannah in that clip from the movie Splash, but I do speak the language of the 80s, because that's what we do best here at Playback, the one and only podcast devoted to translating the retro charms of NPR stories from exactly 25 years ago. This month, we're traveling to May 1984 with an entertaining interview with Ron Howard, the director of Splash. And we'll have the curious story about two oddly matched entertainers appearing together on the South Lawn of the White House.
Michael Jackson is proof of what a person can accomplish through a lifestyle free of alcohol or drug abuse.
That's President Reagan, ramping up his re-election campaign with singing sensation Michael Jackson. Our reporter was there on the scene. And speaking of presidents, we'll have rare tape of a press event with former President Richard Nixon making predictions about the 84 presidential race, including this one about Walter Mondale.
He will bow toward the women, say he's considering one, will interview them and so forth, and will not take one.
Stay tuned to hear more insight on politics. And if that's not enough entertainment, NPR's Susan Stamberg does something we all feel like doing every now and then.
So should I put my head in the box now?
I'd wait a bit.
How will I know? I can't look up at it.
Wait till the photographers get here.
We'll have the full story of Susan Stamberg and Noah Adams attempting to watch the solar eclipse from the roof of the old NPR headquarters on M Street here in Washington. Things are cute as a button this month. Maybe it's because of the Mom's Day thing. Which brings me to our montage of the month, Words of Motherly Wisdom from 1984.
My mother always told me that I should never marry the first man who comes along.
Never to honk a horn for a girl when you're going to pick her up. Always go to the door.
When I was a little boy, she told me that I could get pregnant, and I believed her for a long period of time.
My mother told me always to wear clean underwear.
Well, she always told me she didn't like my attitude.
Don't get in arguments.
Learn to type so I could support myself because my husband would leave me for sure.
My mother always told me that if I didn't eat my meal, all the children in China would starve.
And that I should not marry young.
Get a job and to not get married until after I was rich.
She did tell me I needed to have a college education to run a washing machine. You know, it wasn't just any woman who could do a really fine wash.
She told me that there's a little bit spot of beauty in all people.
She always told me that I could be anything that I wanted. And for a woman of that generation, that was really quite an extraordinary statement.
Yep, you could be anything in 1984. Like, if you got really good at typing, you could be a secretary and support yourself when your husband left you. Or you could get a college degree and get real good at working the washing machine and stuff like that. There was lots to look forward to. After all,
it's morning again in America. Today, more men and women will go to work than ever before in our country's history. With interest rates and inflation down, more people are buying new homes, and our new families can have confidence in the future.
Well, as it turns out, we could all use a little morning in America. And that's just what the creators of Reagan's advertising campaign were banking on. Here's the backstory on this memorable series of ads from reporter Jim Engel.
There are four commercials, each filled with clean-cut, smiling Americans buying new cars, getting married, and moving into new homes. Others are joyously doing routine things such as going to the factory, working the farm, building houses, or painting a fence. The scenes, all beautifully filmed, are largely small-town and rural ones. In short, it is a modern-day Norman Rockwell version of America. The themes of the ads are captured in the working titles of two of the commercials. One is Prouder, Stronger, Better. Another, America is Back.
I think the themes that are in this are themes that the American public today are feeling about this administration.
Ed Rollins is the director of the Reagan-Bush Campaign Committee.
And that is that they are prouder, they are feeling better about things, and we think this is a good reminder of where we were and how far we've come.
Rollins says the commercials were completed last Wednesday after testing them in Connecticut, Los Angeles, Detroit, and Louisville. They were shown to President Reagan Thursday, and the president, says Rollins, was very excited. President Reagan appears in none of them, with the exception of a small picture of him at the end, resting on an unfurled flag. In the same frame, the president's name appears in print the only time it is seen in the ad. In some of the commercials, the announcer says the president's name there as well, but in others, the president's name is never even mentioned.
Just about every place you look, things are looking up. Life is better. America's back. And people have a sense of pride they never thought they'd feel again. And so it's not surprising that just about everyone in town is thinking the same thing. Now that our country is turning around, why would we ever turn back?
I think the president has very high name identification, so you don't need to mention him throughout the commercial. I think you try to create an environment that people reflect on, and I think that these commercials do that.
Ed Rollins says these are only the first of 80 to 100 commercials planned for this year, and that the president will be involved in future ones. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
President Reagan continued to score political points. In May 84, he had the bright idea of inviting one of the most popular entertainers of all time to stand with him on the South Lawn of the White House.
The ceremony wasn't scheduled to begin until 11 o'clock, but by 9:30, the sidewalks around the White House were jammed with tourists and thousands of Washington, D.C. teenagers. And it was clear just who they had come to see.
Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson!
They told him, don't you ever come around here. Don't want to see your face, you better disappear. The fire's in their eyes and their words are really clear. So beat it, just beat it.
Jackson was invited to the White House to help launch a new advertising campaign against drunk driving. A series of radio and television commercials feature one of Jackson's hit songs, Beat It. Jackson provided the tune free of charge. The use of the Jackson song may have something to do with the performer's own pristine image and personal habits.
He's just a nice person to love. He's beautiful.
Yeah. He's
drug-free.
He's a virgin.
Really?
He's a virgin. He's not phony. He's not phony.
How many Michael Jackson buttons do you have on your jacket?
About 52.
How many buttons do you have?
46.
Jerome Scott didn't even have one Michael Jackson button, but that didn't seem to matter to Jerome.
I saw Michael Jackson. Wait a minute.
You're okay,
My mom's going to kill me for cutting school. About four cars came out in front of him, and he came out. We were looking for the white glove, and he was sitting between two guys in the back seat, and he waved, and he saw me. I banged on the window to make sure he saw me. He looked just like Diana Ross.
While Jerome regaled his friends, Mrs. Lee, a self-described grandmother for Michael Jackson, leaned against the White House fence, holding a hand-lettered sign.
My son says, Michael, please stop and say hi to this grandma. Make my day, baby.
What do you think of all these children out here, your grandchildren's age, skipping school just to see Michael Jackson?
Now, don't say they skip school. How do you know they skip school?
They told me they did.
I
got my note right here.
Grandmothers and parents gave permission.
Come out here. Please, Michael.
He's out here.
Inside the gates, White House staffers poured onto the South Lawn, creating a welcoming crowd larger than those for most arriving heads of state. Everyone was on hand, from White House counselor Ed Meese to Lester Harris, a White House painter. Are you going to get into trouble for being over here? Is the president going to send you a memo telling you to get back to work?
No, I don't think so.
You're not supposed to be over here, though, are you?
No.
For Lester Harris, it was a risk worth taking. He was hoping to use his position to slip Michael Jackson a tape of his own forthcoming record. Ooh-wee, it's killing me. After remarks by Transportation Secretary Elizabeth Dole, the President, Jackson, and Mrs. Reagan emerged from the White House. The sun played on Michael's sparkling blue waistcoat, gold sash, and the bejeweled white glove that has become his trademark.
Michael Jackson is proof of what a person can accomplish through a lifestyle free of alcohol or drug abuse. People young and old respect that, and if Americans follow his example, then we can face up to the problem of drinking and driving. And we can, in Michael's words, beat it.
The big question of the morning was, would Michael Jackson speak? It was answered after the president presented the singer with a ceremonial plaque.
I'm very, very honored. Thank you very much, Mr. President. And Mrs. Reagan.
It was feared by some at the White House that in the excitement of Michael Jackson's visit, his message might somehow get lost. But if anyone can convince America's teenagers that drinking and driving don't mix, it's the soft-spoken superstar who shook up the White House today.
The teenagers, they look up to Michael and they respect him, and I think they'll listen. Not only the teenagers, but the adults, everybody.
In Washington, this is Clem Taylor reporting.
But you want to be fair, just beat it!
Now, it's hard to say if our next guest, Mr. Richard Nixon, generated that same kind of heat when he took to the stage, but his appearance did cause quite a media sensation. Here he goes on the record with his 1984 presidential predictions.
I predict Reagan, a victor in November, a close vote. Now, I wouldn't bet the ranch on it, but I would bet the main house, and unless the economy goes down, I wouldn't even bet the outhouse on Mondale.
Yikes, that's not very charitable. But to Nixon's credit, he had a lot of experience when it came to betting the outhouse. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has the story.
Former President Nixon says the 1984 election will pit Walter Mondale against Ronald Reagan. Nixon says Reagan will win, but says the election will be closer than some in the Reagan campaign believe. Nixon suggested the real question for the Democrats right now is who should be the vice presidential candidate. The former president speculated on the thinking of Walter Mondale.
He will bow toward the women, say he's considering one, will interview them and so forth, and will not take one. And the reason he will not take one is not because he doesn't like them, and not because he doesn't think they're qualified, because he thinks a woman on the ticket isn't going to help him, and it wouldn't, for this reason. A woman on a Republican ticket would help because they need them. A woman on a Democratic ticket would not help because the activist-type women who would change their vote for president because a woman was on the ticket are already for Mondale and against Reagan. So he's not going to take a woman.
Nixon says Mondale will choose either Lloyd Bentsen, the senator from Texas, or Gary Hart.
In my view, Hart would help Mondale more than would Bentsen because he reaches a broader constituency in some of the critical states.
But Nixon says for Hart to be considered for vice president, he has to quit running against Walter Mondale and begin running against Ronald Reagan. Would Hart and Mondale get together on the same ticket?
They do have a capability on the Democratic side particularly to get together. After all, if Johnson and Kennedy could get together, I think they too get together.
What does it add up to? According to Mr. Nixon, a very close election, but a Reagan victory. Oh, yes, one other thing.
I know what debates can do for a candidate and what they can do to him. And so there will be debates. And I would predict at this time, Mondale will probably win the debates, but Reagan will win the audience.
Former President Richard Nixon. I'm Wendy Kaufman reporting.
Some clairvoyant political words from former President Richard Nixon. And here's how some of his predictions panned out. I was going to keep it a surprise, but I decided to let the cat out of the bag. Yes, Ronald Reagan won in November. But contrary to Nixon's prediction, it wasn't close. Nope. Reagan won by a landslide, taking every state but Minnesota. And we know that Mondale did pick a woman, the very first woman to run for vice president, Geraldine Ferraro. For today's political predictions, check out the It's All Politics podcast at npr.org. And speaking of putting your head in a box, NPR's Susan Stamberg decided to try it when she heard it was the best way to see the solar eclipse, which occurred in May that year. So she and Noah Adams found their way to the roof of the old NPR headquarters on M Street.
It's 20 of one. You have the tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
I have the big cardboard box. Let's go.
Right. Okay, here we go.
Hey, a lot of people.
A lot of people are out here.
Look at this.
Wow.
Hi.
Hey.
Yes, I'm going to put this carton on my head. We've just had a question from
one
of the people on the roof.
Well, that's because we heard that you can't look at it directly, and you're supposed to look at it through a box with pinholes.
We have to stand with our back to the sun,
mm-hmm.
except there's no sun.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, I see it. There's it. Look right up.
There it
is. There's sun.
That's great.
That ruins this piece.
I was hoping it would rain.
I just saw a crescent. It's begun. So should I put my head in the box now?
I'd wait a bit.
How will I know? I can't look up at it.
Wait till the photographers get here.
It could be a long wait. It's a radio building. No, I'm going to go into the box.
Two more minutes to totality.
Two more minutes to totality?
Oh, wait.
The man says, two more minutes to totality.
You have a
That's like your final destination.
12:45:58.
Noah?
Yes, yes.
It's very dark. I think it started.
No, that's only because you put your head into the box.
Noah, where are you?
I'm right here in front of you.
You want to try on this box?
No. You look fine in the box.
Can you hear me?
A little bit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do you want to put the microphone inside the box with me?
Yes.
Well, here I am inside the box.
What is the time? Ask the fellow with the second.
Time check, please?
Yeah, time check.
30 seconds, exactly.
It's getting brighter.
10, 9,
8, 7, 6, 5, 4,
3,
2,
1.
Nothing happened.
What happened?
Well,
what happened?
What happened?
Where is it?
Wait, no, maybe I'm doing this wrong. Turn around.
No,
oh, go back
out.
In the box?
No. Take your head out of the box and look
out
up
the
at the sun.
There's the sun.
Is that all there is to this?
It's over.
It's over. Wait, we have an expert here.
The maximum is over.
Did you see anything?
No, not much.
Did you see the eclipse?
No.
Did anyone? I couldn't because I had my head in this box.
In the head in the box.
Did you people see any? You saw an eclipse?
Yeah.
What did it look like?
It looked like a crescent.
A crescent. Quarter moon?
So you didn't see a complete blackout with a little golden wedding ring around it?
No, you have to be further south to see that.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wait, Noah.
Yes.
Here's someone who knows.
The heavier the cloud cover, actually, the easier it is to look at.
But I didn't see anything.
It's because you had your head in the box. Now, why didn't the box work for her with the pinhole in?
That's not my department.
Susan Stamberg and Noah Adams, watching the eclipse the old-fashioned way. There was just no getting around the kind of retro Luddite charms of the stories this month. Here's commentator Bill Duncan.
Well, the other day I'm walking through the housewares department of one of these big discount places when suddenly I came across one of my old favorite appliances, something that was really important in my growing up house, the house that I festered as a boy in. They have improved the old fly swatter. Now, I guess many of you remember how fly swatters used to use. Now, I bet a lot of you haven't used a fly swatter in years. Ever since.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I think we got the picture. And along those lines, here's commentator Gordon Baxter.
My friend had been typewriter shopping, and he had seen the new electronic model. He was aglow with it. He kept pressing color brochures onto me. He wanted to share it. He said, look, it all prints off of this little plastic interchangeable disc. You can have several kind of typefaces. The machine is so light, it's not full of any moving metal parts. It just has this little electronic unit down here in the middle of it. And he went on and on. You can move a sentence or a paragraph here or there. Then you can command the machine to print out the corrected page. No longer messing along with erasers or liquid paper corrections. It doesn't even have to depend on that liftoff correction key to change mistakes by simply typing backward letter by letter, which is what my present typewriter does, and I thought that was wonderful. Well, the more he went on and on about this new electronic typewriter, the typewriter of the future, the less I liked it, and I couldn't understand what was my resistance to it. Anything that good and that easy and that progressive must have something wrong with it.
What's good? That's kind of our motto here at Playback. I'm Kerry Thompson.
What's good? What's good? Not much at all. Hey, baby, what's good? What's good?
And speaking of progressive thought, here's a guy who talks fast and thinks outside the box.
Music, life, style, lifestyle, music, all come alive with Ian Scholes, your guide to popular culture. And now, here's Ian.
The word yuppie doesn't connote a Gary Hart supporter to me, but rather conjures the image of a tiny aquarium fish with perhaps a small amount of brain damage. No wonder yuppies are having trouble getting dates. None of us yuppies seem to have friends anymore or know how to use the telephone. Instead, we're going to the personal columns or computer dating services, bringing the same kind of fleshless efficiency to our private lives that we bring to our work. Well, this is one yuppie who still prefers flirtation and romance to relationships. In the section of the daily paper called Life/Style, there used to be handy guides to the opposite sex, usually with a title like Is There Lunch After Marriage, about subjects like wine, chocolate, and orgasms. But all that has fallen by the wayside. The swinging singles are all laid low with herpes. The peculiar, joyless enthusiasm that feminists brought to their bodies in the 70s and the smirking head-wagging that Time magazine brought to the bedroom, all that strange stew we call the sexual revolution has been thrown out the window to be replaced by caution. Caution, pals and gals, is not an aphrodisiac. Only in America do you need a book to tell you what sexuality is supposed to be, and I guess I'm as American as the next gazabo. I read Cosmo and Ms. to find the flip sides of what the gals are and aren't up to. I tried to generate a male lifestyle through cover-to-cover reading of Esquire and Rolling Stone, but now we're supposed to be part of the new celibacy, as advocated by Germaine Greer, who seems to have turned into a kind of feminist Ann Landers, urging young girls to save themselves for kids and marriage. Granted, the sexual revolution went too far. When you find phrases like suck face as a euphemism for kiss, it sort of takes the zing out of intimate personal contact. And I didn't really want to know the precise location of a lover's fallopian tubes. I don't want to be an OBGYN. I just want a simple, steamy workout in the dead of night. Did I learn all my conversational gambits for nothing? Am I supposed to fall back on serious conversation? Give me a break. I boned up on astrology. I learned how to play Trivial Pursuit, for God's sake. I learned how to appreciate the new Woody Allen. I even shelled out hard-earned money for a French movie or two. It's embarrassing enough having all this garbage in my head, but now I'm not even going to be rewarded for it. I say put the new celibacy in the back burner, at least when I'm around. If I want to be repressed, I'll learn how to fix cars, smoke cigars, and play poker. Male bonding is highly overrated, let me tell you, and it will never be as much fun as sex. I gotta go.
There are many waves in the currents of culture. Catch them with Ian Scholes. It's all rock and roll to him.
And if you think the new celibacy idea was avant-garde, consider this. A love affair between a mermaid and a regular human guy. And yes, you'd have the plot line of the fantastically popular 1984 movie Splash, starring Daryl Hannah and Tom Hanks. It was a huge hit. And NPR's Jay Kernis took the opportunity to ask the director of Splash, Ron Howard, what success felt like.
It's unusual that I am feeling it because I've been exposed to a lot of success on a lot of different levels. The Andy Griffith Show was a big hit. A couple of movies that I acted in when I was a kid, The Music Man and Courtship of Eddie's Father, were both really hits and had great reviews.
Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, let me say it once again.
Do you actually remember singing Gary, Indiana?
Oh, absolutely. I not only remember singing it, I remember learning to sing it. I remember learning how to sing it with a lisp. And I remember trying desperately to learn a little kind of soft shoe step that I was supposed to do at the end of the song. And I worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. And I never got to the point where I could do it. And that was the first time when I learned about sort of trick photography or movie magic, because finally the director just said, okay, we're not going to show your feet. And they said just kind of jump around in a circle. So at the end of the song, I sort of jumped around in a circle, and they put in this tap dancing sound, and people think I danced in the movie.
There is yet one place that can light my face. Gary, Indiana.
Gary, Indiana.
And not Louisiana, Paris, France, New York, or Rome. But Gary, Indiana.
Gary, Indiana.
Gary, Indiana. My home sweet home.
Now, the movie The Music Man was released in 1962 when Ron Howard was 8. But generations know him as a perpetually wholesome teenager in the 1973 movie American Graffiti and in the long-running TV series Happy Days. But making Splash was a different experience.
Absolutely the highlight of my career. I think it's because I've always dreamed of directing, and for the first time I feel in a way that I've arrived.
I read that you said from about the age of 8 you thought you wanted to be a director. But what does that mean as an 8-year-old to want to be a film director?
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm not really sure how much I thought of it about it specifically, but I know that when people would ask me what I wanted to do when I grew up, my answer was, I want to be an actor, writer, producer, director, cameraman, and baseball player. I used to love hanging around with the camera crew, playing with the camera and looking through it and talking to them about shots and things like that. But that was just fun for me. But after a while, I realized that the director got to work very closely with those people. I also had a ball hanging around with the actors. And that whole creative process, I remember being very stimulating to, even then.
Are you a good director?
I think that I'm good, and I think that I'm getting better.
Do you get angry with actors?
Oh, very rarely. Very rarely. But once in a while, they'll pull something or get a little lazy on you or something like that. But, I mean, I'm able to just kind of cut through some of the nonsense with actors because they know that I know.
So what do you do the rest of the day?
I have meetings with writers. I hear story ideas. I just finished a production meeting on Cocoon. I'm going to have a casting meeting at lunch on Cocoon where I'll be meeting an actor. Later in the day, I'm going to go do a little bit more promotional work for Splash. It's going to be a pretty full day today.
Director Ron Howard talking to Jay Curtis. Ron Howard went on to win an Academy Award for his directing in 2001 for the movie A Beautiful Mind. The rock group Pink Floyd got together in the 60s, and ever since it has held on to an extremely loyal fan base. And in May 84, rock critic John Rockwell and NPR's Margot Adler chatted together to try and figure out why.
I think one of the reasons that it's lasted is that it looked both backward and forward. It looked backward to psychedelic music of the late 60s, which meant essentially long, spacey guitar solos, sonic experiments, synthesizer drones, whereas it looked forward in the sense that it was essentially a non-vocal style. Such vocals as there were tended to be chanted or overdubbed.
But, you know, there's one thing that I wonder about, and that is, since it just so happens that I am one of those people who have bought the album more than once and found it there in my own record library, I personally believe if it wasn't for that one song, Time, that the album's fame would be much lessened.
As far as the specific appeal of Dark Side of the Moon, I don't know, the title itself has a kind of mysterious aura. I mean, the actual lyrics of the song, such as they are, aren't specifically space-oriented. I mean, there are references to Dark Side of the Moon, but there's as many references to the, you know, the typical whining complaints of rich rock stars that they don't
well,
get to
the
keep
boredom
their money
of work, and alienation, madness,
yeah,
all those
and
things
drugs,
seem to
all
be
of that. I mean, you know, let's face it, space and spaciness are a metaphor for being high. The reason, I mean, bear in mind, it was number one for only 1 week, yet it's been on the charts for 10 years. Not entirely consecutively, mind you. It dropped off a little bit in 75 and 76. That suggests that it has a large but intensely loyal, specific kind of audience. And I would suspect that the vast majority of Pink Floyd's audience is males in their teens. I'll bet you that it speaks very directly to a kind of restive, dreamy adolescent ennui.
I have the sense that you don't really like this album very much.
Oh, no, that's wrong. No. That's wrong. I mean, I'm sort of a fan of Pink Floyd. I like the sound of those long guitar solos set against the synthesizer solos. And I also think that, and you don't get this from listening to the record, that they produced the greatest and most spectacular arena stage shows in the history of rock and roll. The show that they had for an album called Animals, with this gigantic, inflated, 50-foot-long pig that floated over the heads of the people in, you know, a basketball-sized arena with these weird, beady little laser eyes coming out of it. It was one of the scariest and most ominous images I've ever seen in the theater. And I think that this band has a great gift.
John Rockwell, music critic for the New York Times.
I guess the floating pig might be even creepier today, given all the recent talk of all things swine. But we keep our eyes on the prize here at Playback because we know that today's swine is tomorrow's podcast. Support for this month's Playback was brought to you by the Catsif and Spears production unit. And check out, as a matter of fact, the NPR blog that brings us the backstory on all that audio, past and present. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.